good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight.
You're listening to episode 527 of Unwelcome Guests, the emerging field of epigenetics. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we're going deeper than the traditional genetic model of evolution, looking at why in some people genes do one thing and in another person they might do something else. Now, the traditional scientific response to this is to say, well, that's a random effect, but if patterns can be detected, then it's not random. And what we're finding, what scientists are finding, is that there are very clear patterns in genes' behavior, and that there is a method of inheritance, so that effects on one generation are passed down not only through genes to the next generation, but through epigenetic mechanisms to successive generations. So in one of the studies on rats, mothers who licked and suckled their offspring, who showed them love and care and attention the way that rats do, had not only had low-stress children, but their children had lower stress, were stronger, and so on, down to five generations. Now, is that true for humans? The same study hasn't been done, but of course there are spiritual teachings that the sins of the fathers are affecting down several generations, perhaps seven generations or even more. The whole show is going to be based on a dialogue from Vancouver from earlier this year, and it's more of a dialogue, it's fairly open-ended, but I'd like to recall the thoughts of Charles Eisenstein that the Darwinian evolution model doesn't even properly reflect Darwin's thoughts, and it's been seized upon by certain people who wanted a scientific basis for nature's hierarchy, who wanted a replacement for religion to justify domination of others and use of hierarchy, and the survival of the fittest metaphor fitted the bill. That was a century and a bit ago, and in the same way the challenge of epigenetics is that it says, well, that isn't actually how evolution works. So it has some implications for a society with economic and legal systems based on fighting, based on competition. So, to put us in the right frame of mind, let's recall something of Charles Eisenstein's thoughts on evolution.
This is from Chapter 6, Ascent of Humanity.
The purpose of nature. The neo-Darwinian account of the evolution of life rests on two key pillars, each of which is deeply woven into our worldview: random mutation and natural selection. Randomness is the opposite of purposiveness, and a necessary adjunct to a world of standard generic building blocks. Natural selection is the projection onto biology of the ambient anxiety and competitiveness of our culture. These associations ensure that neo-Darwinism will be orthodoxy in the age of separation. But what exactly do random mutation and natural selection act on? What is the biological self that suffers mutation and that competes for survival against other selves? A coherent answer to this question is crucial to the coherency of the entire neo-Darwinian paradigm. If we find instead yet another projection of our culturally constructed conception of self, then the entire edifice of neo-Darwinism is a projection as well. The standard answer is that the subject of natural selection is the gene, biology's version of the discrete and separate self. Through their manipulations of the environment, via the organisms they code for, command, and control, genes enact the struggle for survival that drives evolution. By necessity, their primary relationship to each other is competitive. They are here because over the eons, they out-survived and out-replicated all their competitors. Genes have no desire to evolve, but sometimes they mutate by chance into new genes that are even better at survival and replication. In this way, without any intention or purpose or program, the genes evolve. The only direction to evolution is toward genes that are better and better at surviving and replicating. To the extent that the word purpose has any meaning at all, this is the gene's sole purpose. As for organisms, such as you and I, that the genes code for, these are merely the instruments by which genes survive and reproduce. Insulated like the Cartesian soul from the environment, the interests of the genes are only coincidentally aligned with the interests of the organism. The struggles, desires, and adaptations of the organism do not affect the genes, nor do the needs of other organisms. The relationship between genes and environment is one way. The genes alter the environment through the organisms they program. But the only effect the environment has on the genes is either to prevent them from being passed on or to randomly alter them through mutation. The gene is the master, the organism the servant. The environment is a reservoir of resources and a source of threats. In parallel, we see humankind as the master, technology as the servant, and the environment again as a reservoir of resources and a source of threats. On the individual level, economics and other transactional models of human behavior utilize a structurally equivalent scheme. Life is about me, what I can get, and how I can get it. The integrity of the neo-Darwinian worldview depends on all the elements described above. Remove one, and the whole fabric unravels. Along with it goes a whole constellation of intuitions about the nature of self and the way of the world. Today, indeed, the entire fabric of neo-Darwinism is unraveling, contributing to and impelled by the unraveling of the larger paradigms of the world and self that embed it. We could start with any of neo-Darwinism's frayed threads, and it will lead us to all the others. So let us start with the core of the biological definition of self, the genes. Contrary to the prevailing dogma, the genes are not in fact the command and control center for the cell, nor do they stand in isolation from the non-random and hence, in some sense, purposeful effects of the environment.
This is not epigenetics, but just to make the link with two shows ago, when we heard about how plants have evolved an amazing variety of chemicals. So, for example, the cannabis plant is created these chemicals which activate receptors in humans. Now, that has caused the humans to say, well, this plant is worth having, let's cultivate it. And similarly, for tasty fruits, why is it relevant to the fruit that it's tasty to humans? Because humans decide, okay, well, let's propagate this particular cultivar. So that, as I say, is not epigenetics, but makes the point that nature works in more complex fashions than a struggle for survival, that those plants which fulfill useful functions, beneficial functions, if you like, they give of their gifts to the world around them. Where those gifts are understood and accepted, then it has a mutually beneficial effect. So not to go off onto more complex theories, we're going to get back to epigenetics, which is information which, through not easy to understand mechanisms, is passed down from generation to generation outside of genes, which are fixed and which, of course, are relevant, and which people used to think would determine the future of the organism. Now it turns out that its relationship with the environment, as encoded in epigenetic methods, is of relevance. So without further ado, let's get started on the talk on epigenetic.
This is from Vancouver in April of this year.
What I'm going to do now is ask each person just to tell in their own words, what is their lens through which they look at child development, human development? What do those words mean really to them? And we're not yet getting into the specifics of epigenetics. This is just so you can find out who are they and through what lens do they look at this question of child and human development? So, Ray, why don't you start?
Thank you, Maria. I'm an economist and a demographer, so my specialty is to try to see in populations over time whether our suspicions and theories about how things we do to each other as individuals or in families that might change those families or change how who we reproduce, whether those things actually show up in the population as opposed to being only demonstrable in small groups or in single households. So I'm looking for the population manifestation of the things that my colleagues to my left study and believe to be true.
Okay.
So I'm looking at the more in the individual level because my training is in molecular biology and genetics. And basically, when I think about the question that Marie asked, I'm really thinking about what are the biological mechanisms by which the environment that we live in, by which the experiences that we have, might affect our health, our well-being, our cognitive function in a lasting fashion. Really focusing on the individual, on the genetic structure that we're going to talk about tonight.
Mm-hmm. Clive?
Yes. My basic training is in epidemiology and public health, and so I've been interested in what makes certain populations healthier than others. And so one of the key issues in my world is why is it that in a society like Canada, we have very large differences in health status as you go from the most to the least privileged people in society. It's this kind of gradient pattern. And to what degree does it emerge from things that occur early on in life? Basically, it appears that early life experiences and early development does an awful lot to shape health, learning, and behavior across the balance of the life course. And so my interest in how experience gets under the skin is to understand where that social patterning actually comes from.
And I'm a pediatrician by training, so I think the lens through which I see this discipline has most to do with 30 years plus experience of watching young families grow together, watching children grow up, watching the differences evolve and emerge within families. And I suppose the other lens that I come at this with is as a keen observer of my own two kids who are now 30 and 27, and having watched them over 30 years grow up in the various contexts that they've operated within.
And one thing you all have in common is you're curious about everything. I know that. So we will benefit from where you've gone with that curiosity. Let's just find out a little bit about who's there, because it'll give everybody a sense of just how much information you do and don't have. We got some sense from when you called in how much expertise you have in this area. I know some of you are academics who work in the area of genetics and even epigenetics. How many of you are kind of fit that description? So a few of you. Great. And then I know that some of you are community health practitioners, people here with that point of view. So we'll be very curious to find out what your questions are and how you hope and think this might relate to the work that you do. Employment professionals helping people find work, keep work, make work. Is that, did those people, are you here? Oh, too bad, because I thought that was an interesting kind of way to look at this. People working in the social services, anybody? Education? Okay, I'll represent those people. And people who are concerned wearing their hat as environmentalists, concerned about the environment and ways of affecting the environment. Great, thanks. Who else is out there? What else do you bring? Parents? You wearing your hat as a parent here, some of you, I'm sure? Great. Thanks. Anything else that we should know about who's out there that will help us frame this conversation? Filmmaker. Well, the filmmaker would be...
That's why I wore the tie.
That's why I didn't.
So for you, they will show their good sides. So, and in fact, it's interesting. I too am a documentary filmmaker, and so it's for us, it's very interesting because we wonder what has this got to do with the real world, right? What is this? What are the implications of all of this? So tonight we'll talk about epigenetics. We'll understand more about what it is. How much do we know? How much don't we know? And I think we'll also explore some of those questions about what are the implications of all of this. And we're going to begin with what I'll call Epigenetics 101, but I promise you it'll be very entertaining. And Mike's going to start us off just by giving us a real primer on what the heck are we talking about? What is epigenetics?
All right, that's probably the most difficult question I'm going to face mm-hmm. all evening long, so I tried to make it as simple and as understandable as possible, but please feel free to question me if it's not really clear. And so basically the notion of epigenetics, the actual meaning of the word, the epi, comes from the Greek, and it stands above genetics. So my geneticist's friends are never quite too happy when they hear that. But what it really comes down to is that if we think about human development, what we need to realize is that we get one set of genes from our mom, one set of genes from our dad, and we start out with the fertilized egg somewhere early on. And then as we go through fetal development, when we're born, teenagers, adults, ultimately older people, what we need to realize is that this genetic material actually doesn't change very much. So the genes stay with us, say, for some minor frequency of alterations in the genetic material based on mutations. But I think we all agree that if we, for example, would take a hair, would take some blood, all of the cells in there, they look very different. And yet what we need to realize is they have all the same genetic material. So what makes those cells different? Well, it turns out that this genetic material compromises roughly 25,000 genes in each of our billions of cells. And each cell has a different set of genes that work to different extents, that are turned on, if you wish, like a dimmer, like a switch, a light switch. They can be either totally off, they can be totally on, or anywhere in between. And that is different from cell to cell. And so we have roughly 200 different cell types in our body, and somehow, of course, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to make a blood cell into a skin cell, into a hair cell, or into a nerve cell. And so there is something that specifies the cellular identity in a lasting fashion as we go through the development and as we age. And that's where epigenetics comes in. Because basically what happens is that if we take one of these cells and we were to string out the DNA, the genetic material, the chromosomes that we inherit from our parents, if we were to string it out from each of the billions and billions of cells that we have in our body, from one single cell, it's 2 meters of DNA that needs to fit into a micron, tiny little cell. So I think it's pretty obvious to all of us that the only way we can squish this DNA into the cell is to basically package it very tightly. And this packaging actually is the secret of epigenetics, because what happens is that this DNA is wrapped around particles, protein particles, to form these chromosomes. And these particles and the DNA itself can be modified chemically in many, many different ways. And these modifications, those are the ones that actually determine whether a gene is turned on or turned off, or the level to which a gene is turned on and turned off. And so these modifications and the packaging of the DNA into chromosomes really determines the cellular identity. And so that happens in all of our bodies as we go through development, and it's basically developmental programming, if you wish, of the epigenetic information. We're all excited about this very much, but what we're perhaps even more excited, and hopefully we're going to touch upon this quite deeply tonight, is that on top of this developmental programming, there are actually environmental influences, physical, social, nutritional environmental influences that can tweak with this epigenetic information in specific cell types or across our cell types depending, and alter this developmental programming and alter the trajectory of a cell, of the genetic information in the cell. And so basically the most exciting part about epigenetics to me is that in many cases, once this programming has been established by a given environment, by a given cue, it actually sticks with the cell. It sticks with the organism in many cases for a lifetime. And those are some of the most instructive examples of epigenetics.
So why is that exciting? I mean, what was it that you thought up until a point that suddenly you didn't think anymore as a scientist?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm from a small town, so I didn't think too much first. But I thought we just, you know, grow
That's
up. And I thought we grow up and we live in a good environment and good things are going to happen to us. And I think the what gets me most excited about epigenetics is that it really serves to sort of close that gap between folks like Ray, like Tom, like Clyde and myself, to really close the gap to understand how environmental influences, how life circumstances ultimately translate into lasting effects on health and well-being. That's really the most, because we finally have a mechanism by which we can pinpoint and perhaps then better understand things that epidemiologists and other folk have been thinking about for a long time.
Okay, so when I was growing up in a small town where I wasn't thinking of much either, I did think that I was born with a certain set of genes, and I either won the genetic lottery in some ways and didn't win the genetic lottery in other ways, but whatever I had was what I was going to have. And somehow that maybe I could change my behaviors a bit and change some things, but that was just behavioral. That was just my behavior that was changing. Those genes weren't changing at all. And certainly nothing that I was doing in my life was going to change my children's genetic makeup. In other words, they were going to inherit my genes, not based on what I did in my life. What I understand about epigenetics is that that little story, Clyde, has changed, that the story that I had, that I was born with these genes, is the genes I'm going to die with, or pass on to my kids and then die.
Well, I would say that the core part of the story, which is that the genes themselves are fairly fixed and are passed on in a fairly predictable way, is not wrong. What the epigenetic story is saying is whether or not they express themselves in a given way is very much up for grabs. And it's up to grabs as a result of the kind of environment in which you grow up as a fetus and then as a developing child, it would appear. And we now have a wide range of animal studies and an increasing body of human evidence to show A, that can happen, and B, that when you get changes in the relationship between genes and their expression, that actually can be passed intergenerationally.
So give me an example from an animal study.
Okay. The animal study that's excited the most people, actually, is one done in Montreal by some colleagues of ours named Michael Meany and Moisha Schiff. And what it was about was studying rats. Rats are an interesting species to study because they're very adaptable the way we are as well. To make a long story short, what they demonstrated in these rats was that the level of licking and suckling that the rat mummies gave to their rat pups would influence the way in which the stress response pathways worked through an epigenetic mechanism. In other words, the high licked and suckled rats would have a biochemical cascade that would be set about as a result of the high licking and suckling that would downregulate one of the key stress response pathways, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal pathway. And that pathway would then downregulate the expression of cortisol throughout the lives of these animals. Because cortisol, when it's overexpressed, can toxify and age various organ systems, you could show that throughout those rats' lives, the high-licked and suckled rats had better learning and memory functions throughout their lives than the low-licked and suckled rats. Moreover, because they were rats, they could take babies of high-lick and suckled mothers and cross and give them to low-lickers and sucklers and vice versa and show that it was the licking and suckling phenomenon that was making the difference, and moreover, that the high-licked and suckled female babies who had been born to a low-lick and suckled mother became high-lickers and sucklers when they became
So that's
mothers.
Kind of important to you.
Yes, intergenerational transmission of the effect. So what this has done for a lot of people who study people, is to set about a gold rush looking for human analogs to this.
What does that mean? Oh, human examples.
Human analogs. Are there things going on in human nurturance that are as powerful as the licking and suckling paradigm is in the baby rats, right? And that's the kind of thing that we're interested in.
So what kinds of characteristics are we talking about that can be affected by environment that could actually change the or affect the which parts of the genes are being expressed and which parts are not being expressed? What's the range? Are we talking about licking and suckling? Or like, what's the range?
What's the range? Well, for instance, in one of the studies we're working on, we've looked at whether or not there seems to be an epigenetic mark from growing up at the very bottom of the socioeconomic spectrum versus growing up at the very top, right? And the preliminary evidence would suggest that, yeah, maybe about 6 or 7% of the genome is differentially expressed according to that.
How can you tell?
You can do it through laboratory studies of, you know, taking things like blood cells and studying them. Now, there's all sorts of problems. There's problems about the time course. There's problems about applicable tissues. There's problems about whether or not there's epigenetic changes mean that there's actually metabolic changes that go with it. So it's the beginning of 20 years of research. But we do see those sort of things. We see sort of things where in situations where there's been reports of child abuse versus not, that as much as 20% of the DNA may express itself differently, which is an interesting possibility because it's very similar to what we see in rhesus monkeys, where 20% of the genome seems to express itself differently whether or not you're raised by a rhesus monkey mother versus being raised at what they call peer rear, just throwing a bunch of babies in together with a little rag doll to substitute for a mother and letting them, in effect, rear themselves, right? So 20% of the 20,000 or so genes seem to be epigenetically different based on those kind of differences.
Scary as a mother to hear that.
I don't know if it should be considered scary. I think what we're learning is that human beings may be an awful lot more plastic, that biological species may be a lot more plastic than we thought. So there's no reason for it to be any more scary than it for it to be an opportunity, I don't think.
And that's where your work comes in, Tom, because the question would be, why wouldn't we all respond exactly the same then? Why wouldn't our genetic expression be the same if we were exposed to exactly the same kind of stressors?
Yeah. I'd first want to say that I've always been grateful that I wasn't required as a father to lick my children.
Let alone groom them.
Yeah, there. One of the remarkable sort of vistas that this work has opened up is the idea of conditional adaptation, that the same set of genes being reared in different environments or even slightly different environments within the same family may pull for different profiles of behavior, personality, responsivity.
Health, even.
Even health.
So identical twins.
Development, yes. There's evidence, for example, that identical twins who are, in terms of the sequence of their genome, are precisely the same and remain so largely for the rest of their lives, have broadly divergent and increasingly divergent epigenetic profiles as they go through their lives simply because they have these different experiences. Even if they are twins who, you know, stick together, have early experiences that for all that we can see are comparable, they begin to diverge in terms of the epigenetic packaging of their genome that then turns on and off the genes that Michael was referring to.
So you look at children who are exposed to a certain amount of stress and that you're discovering that children are quite different. You talk about the dandelion children and the orchid children. Mm. Tell me about that.
Well, over the last 15 years or so, we've done a number of studies that have tried to examine not just the stress and adversity that occurs within kids' lives, either within families or schools or communities, but have tried to index something about the child's biological responsivity to those environments and to those challenges. And we find that there are these dramatic differences, a lot of variability in the way that that children respond to adversity, to challenge, even within laboratory settings where we give them precisely the same kind of challenge under precisely the same kind of conditions. And we find that there is a subgroup of children that biologically are very reactive to the kinds of challenges that we present them. And the interesting thing about those children, and we've studied this both in children and in rhesus macaques, monkeys, is that they seem to show either the best or the worst outcomes depending upon the kind of social context that they're being reared in their natural environment. So equally reactive kids being reared in a very supportive, nurturant family versus a child who is reactive and being reared in an abusive or disadvantaged family have very, very different outcomes, even though in terms of the way that they respond biologically to stress is much the same.
Mm-hmm. So that's so interesting because this is the child who is what we used to call, we still do call, sensitive. This is the orchid child. And really they are taken care of and coddled and considered weaker often. And what your research shows is that, in fact, if those very children who are sensitive to the world are in really healthy soil, they really can surpass those kids who are like dandelions who grow anywhere.
Right.
That's fascinating information because it opens up opportunities.
Yes. And it really means that there is among us a subgroup of individuals who have this exquisite sensitivity to the character of the environments mm-hmm. that they're reared in. And the really wonderful and in some sense redemptive news about that is that these very sensitive children, that in one sense you can count that as a deficit or a deficiency, under the right circumstances, they become extraordinary people who do extraordinary things.
So what does that have to do with epigenetics?
Well, that's a good question, and that's part of what several of us here are currently studying here in British Columbia. We're in the process of doing a study where we ascertain children's sensitivity to stress and challenge.
And how do you do that again?
We expose them to stress? We do it in a laboratory where we expose them to carefully calibrated
stress. Yeah.
Just a little bit. With kids, you have to sort of titrate it so that it's enough to evoke the biological response you want, but not so much that they cry. You don't want them to cry.
Okay. Just leave them marked for the rest of their life.
Exactly. Change their epigenetics exactly. by that experience. Yeah.
Right. So Mike and I, along with Clyde, are taking a sample of British Columbia children and are studying them in the lab, and we're going to be looking at a group of stress-responsive genes and looking for differences in epigenetic marks within that subset of genes to see whether kids who are more or less reactive, more or less sensitive to the environment, differ in terms of this set of genes.
And why are you asking that question?
Well, if you think about the public health implications of there being a susceptible, highly vulnerable subset of the population, we know that within any given group of children, that about 1 in 5 of those children is going to be responsible for well over half of the illness, psychiatric disorder, developmental problems within the whole group of children. So 1 in 5 really constitutes half of the bad stuff that we want to prevent. So the public health implications are huge. If we could figure out what is going on with those children and figure out the kinds of interventions that would address the issues that they're confronting, we potentially take care of over half of the morbidity within that population.
So, and I am going to get to you, except I know you're going to turn a corner for us, so I'm just waiting. So whereas before, we could have done that same research just by looking at their behavior. You could have said these three kids are seem to be very sensitive and they had these experiences in life and that makes them not do very well. Mm-hmm. These ones had these experiences in life, and they're doing well. When I hear the story, the difference now is that you're looking at it under the skin. You're saying it's not just their behavior we're observing. We're saying there's something about the way they're, the way Clyde was describing it, their brain reacts, all of the chemicals within the brain that are associated with stress reacts, and all of that. So why is it important that we have that extra layer of information?
I think it's more than just that it's under the skin. You know, 30 years ago plus, when I was being trained in pediatrics, we were in an era of environmental determinism in which we believed and were being taught that one of the causes of schizophrenia or autism was cold mothers, that something about the personality of the mother was what brought forth the disorder in the child. And there was a whole generation of moms who either directly or indirectly were told that their behavior toward their child, the environment that they were creating for their child, was causative in the psychiatric disorder of their child. And that was flagrantly wrong. And there then followed an era of genetic determinism with the rise of the International Human Genome Project, the understanding of, you know, exactly what the genome is, the sequencing of genes within the human genome. And we became swept away with the idea that really it's genetics, it's genetic variation within the sequence of the gene that is determining the outcomes. We have in more recent years learned in a huge breakthrough and understanding that it is neither one nor the other of those, but the two in combination. And what is so exciting about this epigenetic field that Michael is teaching all of us about is that it is biologically the very point of connection between the effect of the environment and the effect of the genome. It's the place where it actually happens.
And you can actually measure it, and you can see it in labs, and so what we'll get to, so maybe you can do something about it that we couldn't have done about it before.
And perhaps one additional point is that we might come to a point where we can use the epigenetic pattern to predict what might happen later on behavior and intervene earlier with some sort of therapies, because it is conceivable, and we need to do time courses to understand this, that the epigenetic imprint that Tom talked about might be manifested much earlier than any subsequent problems that could arise in, say, adulthood.
So just a really quick question before I go to Ray, I promise I'm going to you
no,
next. The next question, is there like this little window of opportunity where whatever is in our environment may decide how dim or how bright the expression of whatever the characteristic in the gene is? Is there a window of opportunity in terms of age? By the time you're 3, is it done and then you're stuck with whatever happened then? Is this permanent? And does it end at some age?
Well, I think first answer is we don't know yet. The chances are that as we learn the answers to that there will be a tendency for things early to matter more than things occur later on, but there probably is a great deal of variation from loci to loci around the 20-plus thousand genes in the body as to when epigenetics matters, if it matters, if it's labile or stable, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of learning to come in relation to that.
So you don't know yet if it's permanent?
I think it probably depends, as Clyde said, from locus to locus. But it can happen as early as fetal development. There is persuasive evidence from animal models as well now, some studies from humans suggesting that maternal nutrition, for example, can dramatically affect the epigenome of the baby to be born, and in many cases lasting throughout the life course of the organism. Of course, cancer is considered has a strong contribution of epigenetic mechanisms, and there the epigenetic changes arise much, much later in life. So it really depends, as Clyde said, and we are only at the tip of the iceberg. One of the next steps is to follow these marks over time in the same person to really get an appreciation for these windows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just building on something that Tom said as well, you know, he was giving you an idea of dandelion children and orchid children to begin with, right? So an idea that kids, in a sense, put something on the table. And the thing that they're putting on the table is different One group is more biologically sensitive to context than the other. But what he's suggesting is among these who are biologically sensitive to context, the pathways, their developmental pathways, might be way, way more diverse than this group here, right? And so the trick really is, on the epigenetic side, we'll probably be understanding with this biologically sensitive context group how the early experiences, which will tend to be the things that will set the trajectories off, are landing and sticking. Right? So for you, at this point, maybe it's a question of, is it all over by age 3? I think for us, it's more a question of working backwards from the idea of a diversity of developmental trajectories to try to understand where a series of critical events could be along the line and then what reinforces them, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's just something for me about, just this is my mother hat now, that if I made mistakes, did something when my children were young, I kind of can convince myself there was repair, there was room for repair, because it was very superficial and it was behavior, and I could do something and be different. To hear that this behavior of mine early on might in fact have changed their basic genetic structure, it is a bit ominous, which is why those questions come about, is it permanent? Does it happen by a certain age? And I think you've clearly said we don't know yet, and that's kind of the questions we're asking, and that there's a reason to ask these questions because you could intervene as opposed to seeing it as a reason to blame the mothers again. But I do have to speak out on behalf of mothers. Your turn, Ray. What do you think when you hear all of this? What's your take on this?
Well, I'm always impressed by the effort and the profundity of the thought that goes into this, but it's as if we live in a historic vacuum. It's as if we don't know what happens to humans when the environments they're embedded in change enormously, both culturally and environmentally, and then how much the humans change. You know, we've been through dramatic changes in how we treat children. It really isn't until the late 19th century that we really started valuing them and, in fact, treating them perhaps in a way that would suggest that investing in them and making their environments more benign would produce better humans. And, you know, that experiment hasn't really produced dramatic results. I would suggest that you go and look at societies where in the last 100 years we've made very draconian experiments in how we treat children, all the way from orphanages and kibbutzes and all sorts of interventions to make them different, under theories that sound very similar to that we're hearing tonight in the abstract. There was, of course, the socialist man and the capitalist man that led to theories of the capitalist liver and the socialist liver. And, of course, empirical work found none of that. In fact, I would suggest that if you go today and look at the average 20-year-old who was brought up in East Germany and the 20-year-old who was brought up in West Germany, blind to where they were brought up, my colleagues to my left couldn't tell you the difference. And I can tell you that cohorts that were brought up under draconian circumstances, we know, for example, from the most dramatic late in history intervention into environments in kids' lives, for example, the Dutch famine, in which for a whole nearly a year, a large fraction of the Dutch population was literally starved, that while that produced discoverable differences in their biological characteristics, it actually makes no difference in how long they live. It makes very little difference in how they perform at school, virtually no difference in their success in the labor market, no difference in how they view politics, no difference in how they raise their children. So while, yes, all that we've heard here is implausible, and I can find evidence for it in the microenvironment and in animal models, looking at human history and trying to find where these dramatic differences in how we treat each other and how we treat our children, whether that produced big predictable differences in the characteristics of the population, the answer is that, for the most part, no.
So you're looking at behavior, about how we're behaving towards each other, as opposed to looking, as we're saying, under the skin at...
Well, I'm looking under the skin as well. I mean, I can tell you that if I looked at what we know about human health, for example, and the probability of our death, it changed virtually immeasurably from about 800 AD until about 1750. Death rates where we have data for those same places are essentially the same, and life expectancy did not change. It changed roughly early in the 19th century, early on in Scandinavia, later in Western Europe, for reasons we still don't know, don't understand. And if I drew a straight line from about 1830 to 1918, before the Great Flu, through those data, and then predicted what life expectancy would be, for example, in Scandinavia today, I would pretty much hit it. I wouldn't have to know anything that happened between 1920 and now. So the argument that what we've done between 1920 and now had a big effect on the average Scandinavian, for example, just isn't true. And Lord knows, they've been through some very dramatic changes in how they treat each other and treat their kids.
So I'm just trying to understand what you're saying. So are you saying that there's no point in looking at the questions of these three gentlemen to your left?
I had better not say that because I'm depending upon them for a ride back to the hotel.
And for dinner.
And a flight back to San Francisco.
We'll take it right now, yeah.
let me be careful what I say here. I do what they do. We do science. And we do that roughly for two packages of reasons. One, because we're curious. And we're just curious about these phenomena. And we'll study them because we're going to satisfy our curiosity. The other reason we believe, for the most part for vain reasons, I will have to say, that what we discover will be important to the remainder of humanity. In fact, what we discover may not be that important. It may never have implications for how we live and the quality of our lives. I can tell you that there was a time. What you hear, by the way, tonight is not very different from what I would call the great hope of Western civilization since about 1820, which is that when we simply know enough about how we treat kids and what that means for us as adults, we will create enormously happy, enormously healthy societies. We'll do the right things. And experiments have been run. And, you know, it's not quite clear to me that these produce the results people would expect them to produce.
So what would produce those results in your mind?
I wish I knew. I mean, I think that we need to be very careful. The argument that we're on the verge of knowing how we should treat our children beyond that which we do by common sense and out of our decency and culture, beyond that, that will make us happier and healthier, seems to me to be a risky proposition because we're not the first to argue that. You've used the example several times here tonight that what we tell parents about how they treat their children and what that means for them induces great guilt. That's the implication. You started our session that way. Tom implied that mothers were made miserable because of what they were said, what they were told. What they were told, by the way, is not that different from what we're implying here tonight, which is that you have control in some critical period over the entire well-being not only of your child but of your grandchildren. Now, I can tell you as a demographer that there's a long history of studying what we call period effects and cohort effects. That means if I encounter a population today, for example, the population of Vancouver, and have to explain the variance in it in health and happiness, I could either start to try to explain that by virtue of what's happening to these families and individuals now, or I can go look at their histories and presume that what I will discover from their histories will predict what I see now. And there's an empirical battle in this field that's been going on for 75 years, not a theoretical or a political battle, but an empirical battle. What predicts best what you'll see when you look at people now? What's happening now or something about them earlier? And for the most part, now, the literature as it stands suggests that the current events predict health better than historic events. Now, it may be because we don't understand history very well, and we don't have good theories, and that's what we're about. But the fact, the claim that we have powerful evidence that what we do to people early in their lives is the best and primary predictor of what they will be later in lives is simply not true.
Whoa. Go ahead, Klein.
Yeah, well, a whole bunch of things. I mean...
First of all, you're the one who's driving him back to his hotel, right?
Yes. I hope. He's walking.
Yeah, right. I'll retract that quickly.
Yeah, right. A bunch of things. First off, the number one paradigm these days in the world of understanding how early treatment could biologically embed itself in terms of making huge difference is, in fact, studies of Romanian orphans. These studies of kids who've grown up in these Romanian orphanages for more than 8 months and then have been adopted out, including BC. There's a cohort of BC are being studied, partly because the effects are so dramatic, in fact. The effects on their stress response pathways, on their behavior, things that won't go away no matter how well they're nurtured later on. So empirically, what Ray is saying is false, A. B, the end of the Soviet period, within 2 or 3 years of the end of the Soviet period in Russia, life expectancy among Russian men dropped by 7 years. So the excess mortality among Russian men in the post-Soviet period exceeded the amount of the Ukrainian famine, which was, you know, induced by Stalin directly. We have a whole bunch of examples of this where social events had huge effects. And if you looked at this, and I've studied this directly because I know about it, that in fact, what did it pick off? It picked off people according to, in effect, what the early investments in their lives were like and what their social environments
at the time
were like.
What kind of investments?
Their education level, for instance. So before the Soviet period ended, the gradient in mortality by socioeconomic status among men was modest. Within 2 or 3 years, that gradient increased to they had 3- and 4-fold differences over 3-4 years in the rates of death, according to whether or not you had less than high school graduation, some college and university in favor of those who had more education. And on and on and on it goes. We have thousands of studies this way. In terms of modifiability of children's development, we have all sorts of studies, hundreds around the world. In the NLSCY in Canada, we know that quality of child care matters, that when kids have good quality child care, it reduces socioeconomic inequalities in their development. We know that using 11 simple questions on parenting style, that those parents who come out as flexible, pragmatic parents, their children do better than the children of authoritarian or exceedingly disengaged or highly inconsistent parents, regardless of their socioeconomic status, et cetera, et cetera. We are littered with modifiable variables in early life. And then we have a whole host of life course studies that start early in life and follow throughout the life course and show what kind of problems with health, well-being, learning, and behavior can be predicted by systematic differences in conditions early on in life and in, say, developmental status by the time kids reach school age. So by the second decade of life, you can predict school failure, early criminality, premature pregnancy. By the third and fourth decade of life, you can predict a lot of mental health problems and obesity. By the fifth and sixth decades of life, you can predict a bunch of chronic diseases. And late in life, you can even predict the rate at which cognitive declines occur in the seventh and eighth decades of life, in part, based on what happens in the early years. And
so this can predict it means that we will fix it?
Oh, we have lots.
If you have to go to the extent of the Romanian orphans to find the evidence, you're really going to the those orphans were subjected to a regime which some scientist in Romania thought would produce good children. If you have to go to that extent to find that profound effect, you're looking for the needle in the haystack. All the examples you gave were examples of how things we do in very narrow periods affect other things that happen in people in narrow periods. You didn't go to what happens to the basic biology.
I was responding to your points, which weren't about the basic biology either. They were
about
population observations.
Yeah, so that was a population question.
Yeah, so
absolutely, there was any proof that what happens in the early years, that's the one you were jumping at. What about this question of biology, Tom? Or Mike.
Well, I think there is.
And actually, we don't need to be defensive. We could actually, now that I think about it, pretend I asked a question that wasn't a reaction to Ray.
So I personally think it's actually an interesting aspect that we do have these studies that Clyde mentioned, and there are numbers of, including some that we have done, that are looking at smaller populations, and then we have the perspective that Ray takes, basically the 10,000 foot view, and taking natural occurrences in large population, and to really understand why is there perhaps a disjoint between the different viewpoints. But I can certainly support. So we have done a study where we actually looked at a subset at around 120, 140 people from the BC area, adults, all healthy adults, and we measured their gene expression profile, the activity of their genes in their blood cells at between age 30 and 40. And what we found is that there consistently was a gene signature that was determined, as Clyde said, that was determined solely by whether these people grew up poor or rich in their first 5 years of life.
So their genes were different.
Gene activity.
Their gene expression was different depending on their early years in terms of poverty.
And they weren't just randomly different. It was much more interesting than that. They were different in a sense that they almost predisposed to a pro-inflammatory sort of state. In other words, the folk that grew up poor had increased activity of their immune cells that was consistent with that altered gene expression profile, that ultimately if the immune system constantly overreacts, that will give you cardiovascular disease, among other things. And that was really also connected to higher cortisol output, the stress hormone in these people. And I should mention, this was independent of the current socioeconomic status. So these folks were actually mixed. They were either rich or poor at the present time, and was solely dependent on their socioeconomic status in life. So again, that's another example that's coming right out of the work that we all do here, consistent with what Clyde was saying. But I do appreciate the view that Ray takes, which is a much more removed view and looking at natural history. I think it will be interesting to sort of close that gap if we can. I think we can, but...
Well, you've been in a meeting all day together, all four of you, so you're probably trying to close that gap all the time. Tom?
Well, let me try this on Ray and see how he would respond. It seems to me that the paradox that we're struggling with is that on the one hand, the human creature is tremendously adaptable. Mm. There's an amazing capacity for adaptation that we have. We can go through a Dutch winter of famine, and we can come out and have a life that is as long as someone who didn't go through that. We can be reared for years even in a Romanian orphanage, and we can 20 years later look like a healthy, thriving human being. So on the one hand, there is this tremendous adaptability. But on the other hand, and this is where the paradox comes in, there is a tremendous variability in the well-being, the developmental health, the physical and psychiatric health within human populations. It's tremendously diverse. And if you go within any human population, if you look at those who are the healthiest and those that are the least healthy, there's a tremendous distance between them. So there's this paradox of us being tremendously adaptable on the one hand, and yet tremendously diverse in terms of how afflicted or healthy we are within individual lives. So how do you resolve that paradox? Well, one of the potential ways of resolving that paradox is the distinction between effects that are deep and profound versus effects that are broad and wide. So, for example, growing up in a Romanian orphanage may have a powerful effect on certain developmental outcomes, but in terms of the long-term well-being of that individual, it may have relatively little effect. On the other hand, we see social class the world over being a powerful determinant of health, morbidity, affliction, well-being. Why would that be? Well, one possible reason for that is that the experience of social class, of where you are in a hierarchical ladder of where you are in your community, within your society, within your neighborhood, is something that virtually everybody experiences. So it's an effect that may be not powerful in terms of huge, profound effects, but one that is spread over virtually the entire surface of the human community, and therefore has a powerful effect.
So you would ask the question, why is there that great? Why is it that people who grow up in poverty are less healthy than those people who are poor? And, you know, I would say, isn't it obvious they can't afford medical care? That's what we've been saying for years. For years we've made an explanation for that. I think most people think they know the answer to that, well, but you're asking it in a different way.
And the interesting thing, though, Maria, is that even though we reflexively think we know the answer to that, when we look at this social class gradient that Clyde was talking about and we control for medical care and we control for diet and we control for exposure to environmental toxins and so on, all the kind of usual suspects of why it would be that people of different social class have different levels of health and morbidity, you control for all of that, and you get rid of maybe only a third of the variance. Most of the variance is still left. So there's still a huge fundamental mystery out there about why that actually happens.
And if you can solve that mystery, what?
If we solve that mystery, what?
If you solve that mystery? If you discover what it is?
The hope is that if we could solve that mystery, if we could understand why health arrays itself along social gradients, that we might then potentially be able to, if you will, disconnect hierarchical position from health and have a more egalitarian society.
Mm-hmm. This Café Scientifique was held at the Roundhouse in Yaletown, Vancouver on April 8, 2010. It was hosted by Maria LaRose and presented by the Center for Molecular Medicine and Therapeutics in collaboration with the Canadian Institutes of Health Research.
You're listening to episode 527 of Unwelcome Guests.